It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Truth in fiction behind the cultural phenomenon that is Top Gun Maverick. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. Welcome to Wednesday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your audio entertainment, Apple, Spotify, or Fox News Podcast. I hope you will leave a comment to this podcast when you view it on YouTube. Today's episode is dedicated to the absolute box office record-breaking phenomenon that is Top Gun Maverick. We have a special conversation today with one of America's true warriors. We have a conversation today with one of America's fighter pilots about the truth and fiction of Top Gun. But first, Michael Sussman, the Clinton campaign attorney, prosecuted for lying to the FBI, has just been found not guilty. As a reminder, Michael Sussman was the attorney for the Clinton campaign who, in 2016, approached the FBI suggesting he had special information about then-candidate Donald Trump that connected Trump to Russia. If you want a full overview of the Special Counsel John Durham investigation into the Clinton campaign and the origins of the Russia collusion hoax, go back to an episode last week here on the Will Cain Podcast with Kash Patel, where we break down the full story of the Durham investigation and the trial of Michael Sussman. You can view that conversation on YouTube or listen to it on the Will Cain Podcast. But a jury in Washington, D.C. has now found Michael Sussman not guilty in the charge of lying to the FBI. One more bit of context. This trial wasn't really, in the end, about lying to the FBI. On both sides, this trial was about politics. What I mean by that is this was but one string and one prosecution in Special Counsel John Durham's charge. In the fall, he plans to bring charges against a man named Igor Danchenko for creating the now debunked Steele dossier, which led to the media narrative that Donald Trump had been compromised by Vladimir Putin with, for example, a prostitute and pee tape taken in a Moscow hotel. False, and John Durham is trying to get to the truth behind this fever pitch conversation that dominated the nation for the better part of 4 years. But improbably when it comes to the evidence, and predictably when it came to the jury, Michael Sussman is not guilty of the charge of lying to the FBI. Why do I say improbably? Let's talk about three big pieces of evidence, first of all. In this trial, it was laid out that Michael Sussman approached the FBI, lead counsel for the FBI, Jim Baker. It started with a text wherein he texted Jim Baker the following, quote, "Jim, it's Michael Sussman. I have something time sensitive and sensitive I need to discuss. Do you have availability for a short meeting tomorrow? I'm coming on my own, not on behalf of a client or company. Want to help the Bureau. Thanks." I'll just repeat, it's a direct quote. "I'm coming on my own, not on behalf of a client or company. Want to help the Bureau. Thanks." There's Michael Sussman suggesting he's just a good Samaritan. He's just helping out the FBI. He has something which turned out to be manufactured false computer data that connected Donald Trump to a Russian bank named Alpha Bank. The data was manufactured. It was false. It was a white paper created by the Clinton campaign through Fusion GPS, but turned over to the FBI by Michael Sussman, a Clinton campaign attorney, holding himself out here in that text as a good Samaritan. In short, the Clinton campaign, like using an attack dog, sicked the FBI on Donald Trump. And of course, the media used that to have hyperbolic, fever pitched conversations for the better part of 3 years. But that wasn't the only piece of evidence. In the trial, Jim Baker, again, lead counsel for the FBI, testified. No, Sussman never said he represented the Clinton campaign. He never did. And I would have verified. So not only do you have the text, you have the lead counsel for the FBI testifying that Sussman never told them that he was repping the Clinton campaign. And yet he was representing the Clinton campaign. And you can't really separate church and state and saying, well, at times he was representing the Clinton campaign and others, he's just being a good Samaritan. Why? Because I give you the third piece of evidence. He billed the Clinton campaign for that time in visiting the FBI. You know, lawyers work by the quarter of an hour, less at some big firms. They bill in 7-minute increments. He billed them for that time, and he billed them for the thumbnail drive that he gave to the FBI with all this manufactured data. You getting this? He billed them for the pencils and the time, the thumbnail and the visit. And yet somehow, improbably, in the face of all of that evidence, a jury finds him not guilty. How? Well, this is where we return to the idea that everything is political. A jury is made up of, yes, your peers, but your peers who have opinions. In Washington, D.C., while pulling a pool of jurors, you have to understand that you're dealing with, I don't know, D plus 40? It's one of the most liberal districts in the United States of America, right there with San Francisco. In fact, in 2016, Washington, D.C. voters chose Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump by a margin of 91-4. 91% to 4%. This is what comprises your jury pool in Washington, D.C. In fact, good luck on Vodai or getting out any compromised jurors, because you're dealing with people who ended up on the jury who literally donated to Hillary Clinton's campaign. I mean that. You have several jurors who work, for example, at liberal think tanks or sent money to Hillary Clinton, or who had children who played on the same teams as Michael Sussman. This is what you're dealing with. This is reality. There's principle and there's law and there's evidence, there's facts, and then there are opinions and reality and partisanship. Michael Sussman has been found not guilty by our justice system for lying to the FBI, despite what we may know, despite the facts. You know who else was found not guilty? O.J. Simpson. John Durham moves on from here. Again, he has the prosecution of Igor Danchenko. And let us hope that he has the same congressional mandate, funds, and energy behind him that did Robert Mueller. In other words, let's hope there's a John Durham report that's published for the public about the origins of the Russia collusion hoax. We can't hope for a ton of accountability. We can't hope for somebody big in handcuffs. We can almost certainly not hope for accountability to land at the steps of Hillary Clinton. But we can get the truth. Here's hoping we get it from John Durham. A few years ago now, when I was working for ESPN, on Veterans Day in November of, I'd say, 2016, I got sent to Luke Air Force Base in Arizona. First Take did Veterans Day shows from various military installations across the country. And that year, I got sent early to Luke Air Force Base. Why? Stephen A. Smith is afraid of flying, and Max Kellerman was too cool. So I was given the assignment. I was given the honor of getting to do a training mission with fighter pilots from the 309th Fighter Squadron at Luke Air Force Base. The Mad Mallards from Hell, as they are known. I got to go up with Jeremy Hedges, Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy Hedges, call sign Thumper. We went on a training mission. We strafed targets. We got involved in a dogfight. We pulled 9.2 Gs. And I went through training that day on how to survive heavy G-force. I thought this past weekend, as I went to see Top Gun Maverick like the rest of you, because Top Gun Maverick is breaking box office records. And that's fascinating in and of itself. Here's a theory. For well now decades, an entire generation of people have thought, well, movies, that's where I go to get slightly entertained and heavily moralized to. It's true. Like, when's the last time you just had fun at a movie? Just popcorn, Coke, and a good time. That's what the original Top Gun was. That's what Top Gun Maverick is. There are people saying it's better than the original. I heard someone say today it's one of their favorite movies of all time. And I think that's in part because people just want to have fun again. And perhaps for some young viewers, they don't even know what it is to have fun at the movies. I had fun. You should go see Top Gun Maverick. For those of you that already have seen it, you're going to enjoy this episode. For those of you that haven't, I want to give you a spoiler alert. Over the next 30 minutes, we're going to talk about the truth and fiction behind what you see in Top Gun Maverick. What can pilots really do? What can they really pull off? But there are plenty of spoilers, many spoilers about what happens in the movie. If you haven't seen it yet and you proceed from here, you have been forewarned. I will ruin the surprise. If you're cool with that, keep moving forward. If you're not, go see Top Gun Maverick. Then come back to this episode of the Will Caine Podcast, where we break down the truth and fiction with Jeremy Hedges, Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy Hedges, my friend, Thumper, here on the Will Caine Podcast.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow Podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Let me get this straight. Tom Cruise can bomb a unidentified enemy target in 2 minutes and 15 seconds, but you're 15 minutes late to an interview, Thumper.
Like I said, it's that's why we have maintainers, because I'm not smart enough to actually have all the stuff ready for me on time. So I just show up and it's ready for a go. You can't expect an old lieutenant colonel to be able to take care of that kind of stuff.
Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy Thumper Hedges here with me on the Will Caine Podcast. When I met you, Jeremy, you were with, and I'm going to hold this up for anybody watching this podcast on YouTube or Rumble, the 56th Fighter Wing. You were with the 309th Fighter Squadron. You can see there, Duck Viper Driver, the Wild Ducks of the 56th. Here's the original Mad Mallard's patch, I believe, Jeremy, from 1944. Here's the updated one from the 1950s for the 309th Fighter Squadron, whose motto is QQMF. Quack, quack, and I'll leave for the audience to fill in the MF. And you guys gave me the call sign of Right Wing.
Right Wing.
So we decided, you and I, when I texted you yesterday, this would be Into the Danger Zone with Thumper and Right Wing. It's good to see you again, man. It's good to see you. I'm glad to have you on the podcast. So I texted you and said, have you seen Top Gun? And you said, please. And so now I think you've seen it twice. So everybody in the Air Force, not just the Navy, but everybody in the Air Force was ready to go out and see Top Gun right away.
That's true. We had squadrons that went Thursday night on opening night. We actually had one squadron that somehow got tickets on Wednesday night last week and went, and it's pretty much every fighter pilot that I know in the Air Force has at least seen it by now. So even though it's a Navy thing, we're Air Force, it's still a good movie. It's still got some nostalgia for all of us, and we definitely wanted to go see it. So,
and you told me the losers of your fantasy football league last 2 years running had to do what?
That is true. So obviously this was supposed to come out 2 years ago, and it was only supposed to be one guy, but because the release got dragged out for so long, there was two guys. And the last place guys from our squadron's fantasy football league the past years had to dress up in their full flight gear, flight suits, G suits, harnesses, and even their helmet and mask, visors on, and walk into the studio and watch the movie. So it was amazing.
You made them wear their G suits. I personally know how uncomfortable sitting around in a G suit is for 2.5 hours, which is part of what we'll talk about today. The several days you and I got to hang out together at Luke Air Force Base in Arizona. And I wanted to talk to you. I texted you. I said, hey, let's go over Top Gun. Let's separate fact from fiction together. So before we do that, let's start with this, Thumper. What did you think of the movie in general? Did you like Top Gun? How do you compare it to the original?
I loved it. And like almost everyone else I have talked to, except for one person, thought it was even better than the original. I know a lot of the nostalgia plays on it. Obviously, we've been watching the original one for 36 years, I believe. But I thought it was amazing. Yeah, some of the flying scenes to a, you know, to somebody who's a fighter pilot are a little like, that's not quite exactly how it would go. But just overall, for just entertainment wise for the movie, I thought it was amazing. A 10 out of 10.
Hey, I think you're a little bit younger than me. Did the original Top Gun inspire you at all to become a fighter pilot?
Not really. I was six when the first one came out. So I was in my teens before I had seen it. So it didn't really have a bearing as far as me choosing to become a pilot. But once I decided to go that route, that was definitely, I've seen it many, many times. It's quoted often at work. Yeah, it's definitely plays a factor in our lives. And has
it's really cool. It's really cool, by the way, that you say that even though there are parts of the movie that are eh, it doesn't ruin it for you. I've spent some time, I would never describe myself as a cowboy, but I have spent some time on ranches in my life around real cowboys. And there's nothing that ruins a Western more than when they see the wrong way a saddle is set up or the wrong way a guy would be dressed. But you're I think, in the right mindset of just simply enjoying this movie. By the way, Thumper, I think that's why people are having such a good time and it's setting box office records. I think we're so tired of going to a movie and getting moralized that this is a movie where you just get to go have fun. And for young people, by the way, it might be the first movie they've seen in decades where the point of the movie isn't necessarily the accuracy of the portrayal of fighter pilots, but it is just to have fun.
Yep. And it definitely does that.
Let's do this. Let's separate, though. Let's go fact from fiction. Let's start with fact first. You gave me three of each. Let's start with what you thought in Top Gun Maverick was the closest to real life, the real life of being a fighter pilot.
Got it. The first one that I thought was when they pulled G's. There are some scenes where, like, when he's trying to climb out of the cliff, like, as soon as you get your nose pointed up there, you're like, you're no longer pulling G's. But in that initial pull, you know, as you saw when we went on our flight, we pulled a little bit over 9 G's. We'll just say we pulled right at 9 G's. And as you can see, the way they describe it just visually, where you're basically, as you start to pull those G's and you get on your G strain and you've got the equipment helping you strain. But if you keep it up too long or you don't have a good strain or it's too many, visually, then you start to get that tunnel vision where you get gray in from the sides, and then it starts to turn black, and you basically go from having a 180 degree peripheral view into almost like that soda straw. And like, that's when you, if you realize that point in time, obviously you need to let off the G's, get on your strain harder, and all that kind of stuff. I thought it was a very good depiction of that as well. When the one guy G-locked, and I should have wrote his name down.
Coyote.
To go down. Yep. And then he, you know, so he takes the tone on him and tries to get him to wake up. That was a very realistic depiction of when somebody G-locks. So you'll be out for 6 to 9 seconds, and then, but you can be back awake, and then it still takes a 30 up to 30 seconds while your mind is basically restarting, like recaging. Hey, where am I? What am I doing? Oh, I'm flying in a jet that's in full afterburner and pointed right at the ground, and I need to wake up and recover this airplane. I thought that was a very realistic presentation of that. I would think, or at least hope, that a new F-18 has AG CAS on it, which is auto ground collision, where basically the jet realizes you're pointed right at the ground and it recovers it for you. The newer F-16s have that. The F-35s have that. I would like to hope that the F-18, but I don't know that for sure. But still, overall, the portrayal of the G's.
So, look, this is my major takeaway from the days I got to spend with you in a simulator, but then going up on a training mission and then all the preparation for the training mission. It was all about G's. Like, we spent hours in a classroom learning about the effects of gravitational force on our body, being fitted for a G suit. And so for those listening, the G suit is almost like a wetsuit that I wore, that you wear over your flight suit, and it sucks your body tight before it's even in action. You're already sucked tight. And then and Jeremy, I want you to correct me where I go wrong. You plug it into the plane, and the whole idea is when those G's begin, when you start pulling those G forces, the suit constricts and starts pushing because, and he says it in Top Gun, the effect of gravity on your body is to push the blood and the oxygen out of your head towards your feet. And so the G-suit is trying to push all this blood back up into your upper body. Do I have that right? That's what I remember, and both from my quote-unquote training, but also from being in the cockpit with you, man. I remember that distinctively.
Yep. So it's just like wearing another pair of jeans, a little bit oversized, or a pair of snow pants, and then basically just their inflatable bladders in them. And as you start to pull G's, the more G's you pull, the harder the jet pushes air into those pants and inflates, and basically just, like you said, squeezes, constricts your legs, your thighs, and even up to your butt and gut a little bit more, and just squeezes it. The more G's you pull, the harder it squeezes, and the point is to keep the blood out of your legs so it can keep up in your cranium.
Right, so you don't black out. So when we took off, I remember taking off with you, and it's all fine and dandy, and it's a normal flight. And I think you gave me some warning, but I mean, like a roller coaster, you know, you got up in the air, and then you just immediately took straight off up into the air. I guess not vertical, because you just said if your nose is straight up, are you not pulling G's if your nose is straight up?
So while the nose is moving, you're pulling G's. But once the nose stops moving up, now you're basically just at one G flight.
Got it. So I got there and I was like, wow. And you said to me, okay, that was good. That was good. And I think on our ascent, you said maybe 3 to 4 G's is what we had pulled. And I knew the goal going into the mission of what we would end up pulling, which you said, and I don't know the regulations. So I want to be mindful of, right? You said 9, but I'm tempted to brag that 9 might be conservative.
Fairly, but yes.
Okay. I do have a pin. I do have a pin you gave me that shows exactly how many G's I pulled. By the way, is 9 G's, like, I do brag about that. Might have been 9.2, might have been 9. I'm not saying, I don't know. I can't remember off the top of my head. But is that a lot? Like, for you, for context, give me, like, in the movie, by the way, I think when they're pulling out of that canyon, he does 10 G's at some point. Like, what is, in your mind, like, when you're at the bar, and I know you're at the bar after a training mission, and you guys are breaking out the Jeremiah weed, what kind of G-force are you guys bragging about to each other?
Usually, if we've been doing it long enough, we were just like, why did I pull so many G's? That was painful and that hurt. We don't necessarily brag about it anymore. 9 is definitely painful to us still. I'm comfortable probably up to about anything more than about 6.5. I start to be like, okay, this is G's and this isn't super fun, and I don't particularly want to be here any longer than I need to be as far as pulling that many. But anything between about 6.5 to 7 and all the way up to 9, that's about where I'm just like, okay, this isn't fun or comfortable. So
okay, so the day you took me to 9, you were punishing yourself just to prove a point to me.
Exactly.
Here's what I remember from that, by the way. You know, obviously you have no strength left in your neck. Your head is back up against, or mine, back up against your seat rest. Your helmet is pushed back. I remember my oxygen mask came off a little bit, so it kind of tilted this way, so which made me nervous. And am I not supposed to be sucking in direct oxygen, pumping oxygen? And I'll remember, Thumper, that my right side started to close. I didn't black out, and I didn't throw up. Which, by the way, was what all the training was about. But I remember my right side started to black out, weirdly, just on one side of my eyesight. When you do this, by the way, and you take other people up, because you guys take up congressional delegates, you take up other media members. Am I in rare company for not throwing up? I want to believe that I am. Do you get a lot of pukers?
You get more pukers than not, definitely.
Really? Over 50% puke?
Yes. Definitely.
Okay. All right. I feel good.
You know, if we've got somebody that we know is extremely sensitive, you know, when you showed up, you were just like, I want the experience. So, all right, we're going to give you the experience. But we have people that show up and they are extremely nervous and scared, and that we may lay off a little bit on them if that's what they want. Because the whole idea, even though I want you to experience what we're going through, like, at the end of the day, I want you to have fun. So, I mean, I can go out and pull 9 G's for 30 minutes straight and make you pass out and make you throw up and all that kind of stuff. But, like, if you walk away and you didn't have fun, you didn't really learn anything from it, then, like, I kind of wasted my time and your time and the taxpayers' gas. So,
okay. So, you thought their representation of the G's was accurate. What else? We're going to do 3 of these. Number 2, what do you think was accurate?
The second one I thought as I watched the movie on the second time, so when they rise up in the canyon and they roll over and go and try to hit that target, I thought it showed a pretty good accuracy of the difficulty of placing a laser spot while you're in a dive like that on a very short dive. A lot of times when we're lasing a bomb in, we practice to do those dive ones like there. We call them dive glides. And it's a very short laze time. Usually that's not how we apply them or employ them. But the difficulty that they had as trying to acquire a target with a laser spot and lasing it through a post-release action as well, too. I thought that was actually a fairly realistic depiction. Obviously, some of that was brought on by their 10 Gs and his ability to not even see anything. But the difficulty in getting the targeting pod to find that laser spot, I thought that was actually a pretty good representation as well,
hey,
too.
I wanted to ask you about that. So it's interesting. When I went up with you, you fly the F-16, or you did fly the F-16. Now you are training on the F-35. The F-16, if I remember correctly, even though there are two seats, it's a single man flight plane. Isn't that correct?
For the U.S., yes. There are other countries that employ it as a two man system, but yes, the U.S. flies it as a single man.
So in the F-18s in Top Gun, there were some teams that were, I assume it's pilot and navigator from the original Top Gun. That's what I remember. Maverick and Goose was pilot and navigator. It was a two-man team. In this movie, there were some that were two-man teams and some that were not. And I kind of didn't understand that. For example, Phoenix and Bob ran together, whereas Rooster ran his F-18 by himself. And what made me think about that is you talking about the laser pointing. That was the wingman as well. It was the secondary plane who was laser pointing the site while the lead plane dropped the bomb. What help right. me make sense of all of that?
So the Navy flies Super Hornets, F-18Es and Fs, and those are basically a single seat version and a two seat version. So they both employ those throughout their fleet. Again, I'm not a Navy guy, so any Navy people that are watching, I'm sure will write in and tell you all the things that I said wrong about the Navy. So the E models, I believe, are the single seat ones, and then the F models basically use a weapon system operator, a WISO in the back. I know in the original Top Gun, they called them RIOs, Radar Intercept Officer. I think they're called WISOs now. Basically, so they employ those, and I don't know, not smart enough on Navy to see how they actually employ those differently. I believe they're, you know, whether they're in the same base or same squadron or how that goes. But I know that the Navy does use both of those very routinely.
So I wanted to ask you, I don't remember if when we met a few years ago and did our training mission together, if I mentioned this, my audience is going to be like, Will always talks about this, but I'm sort of a John Boyd fan. I don't know if I told you that several years ago.
You did.
But John Boyd, who developed the F-16 for the Air Force, was maybe the most famous fighter pilot in American history, if not the most, one of the most famous fighter pilots in American history. And you flew the F-16. And by the way, I told you why I'm a John Boyd fan, that one of my kids' soccer coaches turned me on to John Boyd because of his development of OODA Loop, which is a fighter pilot training system of observe, orient, decide, and act. It's essentially the thought process you go through in a dogfight and loop that. And the guy that can go through that decision-making process the quickest will win the dogfight. I was curious about, you've moved from the F-16 to the F-35. You're now doing that, right? And in the movie, they talk all about this fifth generation fighter from this, whatever country it is we're fighting in the movie. They never say. But is that what it's like with the F-35? Does it feel like you're in this quote unquote fifth generation fighter against an old timey jet in the F-16?
When you're dogfighting, I wouldn't say it feels that different. To me, dogfighting is dogfighting. The F-35 has strengths and weaknesses. I wouldn't say it's that different. If I had to dogfight, I'd rather be in an F-16.
Really?
It is a lightweight fighter, and it is made to be amazing in dogfighting. Outside of dogfighting, I would absolutely agree that I'd rather be in a fifth generation platform, because the amount of sensors and that provide situational awareness, that, I mean, it's just, it's it is night. I would say it's night and day, but that's not even a strong enough comparison on how different it is moving over to a fifth generation platform and the things that it can do.
Do you remember in the movie when he takes on? And so, by the way, what you're telling me is you kind of back up what they say in the movie. It's not the plane. It's the guy in the box. It's the pilot. And this is going to be, I'm going to give plenty of spoiler alerts, but he wins a dogfight with a fifth generation fighter while he's flying an F-14, I believe, towards the end. So you're telling me from a dogfight perspective, I mean, you're talking to an F-16 was built specifically for dogfight. That was Boyd's idea, right? It was built for dogfighting. I can't speak to the F-14, but he does win against a fifth generation fighter, against an old dogfighting plane. But there's that one maneuver where the fifth gen, it's not hitting the brakes and doing a Cobra. He does something else. It just kind of goes horizontal. Yep.
It's a controlled flight. And
is that realistic? Do you do that in your F-35?
We do not. It is not that crazy.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Take me to number three.
I'd be too terrified if it started to do that. I'd be, what? This airplane's not flying. I'm just along for the moving through space.
Take me to number three. Most accurate thing about the movie.
Number three, it was a very quick scene. It's when Phoenix and Bob have their emergency procedure and they take the birds. And just the amount of, I thought basically it wasn't a lot of the way they worked together with crew coordination and how Maverick was also kind of helping them out a little bit and saying, hey, basically, so we talk about like, hey, if you're getting ready to eject and you're going down, it'd be a talking altimeter for the other person, like you're 8,000, 7,000, but more just the way they work together. How they, okay, they tried to, they had the fire on one side, so they tried to put that out, go to the other engine, okay, which is, hey, that's one of the bonus of having a two-engine fighter, which I've never flown, but at least you've got a backup one, so that one's nice, but then that one fails too. Okay, hey, let's try to put this first one out, and let's keep going. I thought just the way they handled that scene, the crew coordination that they did between each other and amongst the other fighters, I thought that was actually fairly realistic as well, too.
So. Yeah, the Tomcat. Two engines, F-16, one engine. I meant to ask you. So I would imagine, I'm going to guess, you haven't had to bail out of a plane before. You haven't had to eject.
I have not.
Okay. And it cost the government millions and millions of dollars. But have you taken a bird strike?
I've had one hit the wing before. So yes.
Okay. And then have you ever had, you were talking about earlier, G-lock?
Nope. In the centrifuge, I have. So the centrifuge, basically, when we're training, it's a system that's basically in a room where the thing spins you around and around, and you learn your own tolerance and practice at those high Gs before they actually go put you in a fighter to do that and make sure you have the natural tolerance. I didn't do so well on my first attempt at that. So, yes, I have with that. Thankfully, not in an airplane, though.
Okay, so now I think this is the part people would really enjoy and probably want to know. What doesn't make the cut? What makes you go, eh? What's not real? What makes you roll your eyes? In Top Gun Maverick, let's go through your top three fictions. Number one.
The number one, ejecting at Mach 10.4. if you eject more than 450, 500 knots, you're going to have severe flailing injuries. You're going to have both your legs, both your arms are going to be broken. It's just that at those speeds and F-35, we have a suit that's designed to try to like pull your arms back in when you eject. But even that, we can't obviously go anywhere near Mach 10, but there would be nothing left of your body if you ejected at Mach 10. I mean, you see the picture from the ground as the plane is like disintegrating into pieces. Like if it did that to this titanium alloy skin airplane, like the fact that his body would just be like, he looks like he just kind of rolled around in the mud a little bit when he walks into that town and in that bar and drinks that water. Just like laughable would be an understatement. You're not surviving a Mach 10 ejection.
Wait, what is 400 to 600 knots? What is that in terms of Mach?
Depends on your altitude. Low altitude, it would be probably 0.8-ish in the 30s. 400 would be pretty close to supersonic, about Mach 1, but that's only a tenth.
Yeah, I was going to say, so you're saying at Mach 1 at that altitude, you're breaking bones. And yeah. ejected at Mach 10.
Yep. There's been a few high speed ejections like that in the Mach 1 area in the Air Force. I know one of them was a Strike Eagle where the backseater actually lived through it, but again, just everything was broken and all his extremities. So,
wow.
Not at Mach 10.
Okay. Second biggest fiction in the movie.
The training rule violations, the violations of the hard deck. I thought the first one,
careful, like
where they do the Cobra maneuver, I think they called it, when they go to basically to 69 feet off of the floor, and they both pull out at the last second, but they just blatantly disregard, the quote unquote, the hard deck. I mean, we treat that in training. You would never do that, even if you're trying to prove a point with a guy who killed your old man in the backseat of an F-14 Tomcat 35 years ago. That's just the training rule violations that would never, we were sitting next to, in the group of, that we were sitting and watching it on Thursday night. And it was like, and one of the girls, she was like, that's a training rule violation. That's a training rule violation. And she was just being able to say funny. And it was, but I mean, just like the blatant disregard that they do that and then pulling out so low and stuff like that, like, would not happen in today's military. You probably, to be able to do it that late, you probably would have, one of the persons would have, people would have crashed at least, but at the very least, they would not be flying military aircraft again after that.
But that's what makes him Maverick. He doesn't obey the regulations. And the
training part of it, and that's where we go, we separate the entertainment from the reality.
I know this is probably a complicated question. I don't remember how low they got. You're talking about the Cobra when they were spiraling each other sort of in a standoff. Yep. As the earth is coming down close to them, and then they pull out at the last moment. I can't remember what their altitude was when they pulled up. What is the lowest sort of in that kind of dive? And I know it depends on the dive and depends on the angle, I'm sure, or whatever it may be, where you could pull out and get the plane back from hitting the ground.
So, I mean, we do low angle strafe in the F-16, the F-35, where we get as little as, you know, we get recover by 75 feet off the ground. But that's when we're coming at a 10 degree angle versus a 90 degree nose low angle like they were doing that. Normally, when we do low levels, the basic fighter qual is 500 feet. And that's when we're just flying like straight and level at mm-hmm. a low altitude. If you're more experienced, 300 feet for our weapons school graduates, the Navy's equivalent of Top Gun, that most of them are qualled down to 100 feet. But again, that's as you're flying straight and level. That's not as you're pointed straight down at the ground like that.
But so your attack angle is 10 degrees, you're saying, and you can go on that down to 75, yeah, to 75 feet?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Number three, biggest fiction.
The welded wingman, and this one kind of plays into the low altitude stuff a little bit, how they fly that, you know, they fly the two ships that the welded wingman is what they called it. And it's basically just a little bit wider than a fingertip. That is not a tactical formation. The people that are the best at that are the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels. They are amazing at that. We fly fingertip that close basically for about 15 seconds as we come up initial to pitch out and land back in the pattern. That's not, and if we don't have radars, we'll use that to penetrate the weather as well too. But you would never fly through a canyon at 100 feet off the ground, doing 660 knots, according to them, with basically somebody in fingertip. It's not tactical. You would spend, that would last about 10 seconds before you'd bail out of that and go to a more reasonable attack formation. Usually attack formations like that, you know, what do we attack in? And, you know, in the F-16, it's, you know, we're a mile to 5 miles apart. The F-35, or even further than that. Basically, we're just flying with each other in sensors. But flying that close to each other is not realistic. It's not something that we would use to attack.
You know, back to when we were together, I remember you taking me through some quote-unquote canyons. They were nothing like what was portrayed in the movie, where it's like these walled canyons, you know. But you took me through some canyon-esque areas in Arizona. We hit a training target. You strafed a training target. I don't remember. Did we drop bombs? I don't remember if we did that.
We didn't drop bombs. Just strafed.
Yeah. Yeah, and even that, I mean, look, I'm just a guy who's normally on a commercial flight. But even that, those canyons, I'm like, everything. And when you went low, and I don't remember how low we went, but it was... Everything feels this close. Everything feels this close. And you're talking about, and it's much further than what they portray in the movie.
Correct. Yeah, so if you were that close in doing, so we went down to 300 feet on our flight because that's what I'm qualified down to.
Yeah.
I'm spending 99% of my time while we're down there looking outside of the train and stuff like that. So for the guy in the front, it would be fine. But for that number two, that wingman, he would want, being that close to operating to his number one, he'd want to spend all of his time looking out front at his number one. Yeah. And basically, he would not be able to spend any time looking around at the canyons or that 100 feet. Those, they made that cool scene where they flew across the lake on the actual run, all that kind of stuff. So just not realistic. Cool, but not realistic.
Okay, here we go. Really quickly, I'm going to run through with you my two biggest fictions and two biggest facts, okay? And you tell me if I'm right. First of all, wings out, short runway takeoff. Come on. Over whatever it was, just a flat wall embankment, the climactic scene of the movie, that's not in your top three biggest fictions?
No. That's. I mean, it was a slightly longer than an aircraft carrier, and they did at least do a good job by, you know, they went, made the wings go out so that provide more lift. That's definitely what why the Tomcat okay. flies in the lower speed regime. That'll give you more lift. But yeah, no, that's okay. a fiction for sure.
Here's the biggest one. How does Tom Cruise take a missile, not deploy his parachute, and just sort of shake it off when he's on the snow after his plane crashes? He doesn't. I understand it's Hollywood, but the next thing I know, Tom Cruise is cool. Like, his plane's blown up. He took a missile. He didn't deploy his parachute, and he's like, shakes his head and he's ready to fight.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess
really?
I thought it just didn't show, just to kind of build the suspense to know if he had bailed out or not. I guess I assumed that he had. So
wait, did he deploy his parachute?
I thought so.
Okay. He's not surviving if he didn't deploy his parachute, right? Come on. We can't not pretend all. There's some way to survive that.
You're not. Correct.
Okay.
Parachuter, your game is over.
Okay. Now, my two biggest truths. Number one, the dogfighting is amazing. And I'm going to start with the compliment. And I said this that day after hanging out with you and Viper and other guys. Listen, Jeremy's an understated guy, as you're listening to this right now. You're talking about, I think it's easy to see a high-level skilled warrior when they come to you in the form of, say, a Navy SEAL or a Green Beret in their prime. Fighter pilots, by definition, are understated both in their personality and sometimes in, you know, their physical presence. And I'm not saying you're not intimidating, Jeremy. You're incredibly physically intimidating. But man, you spend just a few moments with these guys in your environment, Thumper, and it is so humbling. I feel like I will forever be your sidekick. Like, I mean, you have alpha male over me for the rest of our lives, no matter what either of us accomplish, because I was sitting there riding shotgun with you as I just saw a human being control a massive technological piece of machinery to the height of your and its ability. And I'll tell you something, you and I did a dogfight together. I think with Viper. I never saw him once.
Joker.
Joker. Yep. I never saw Joker once. I literally, you know, looking at the canopy, I couldn't see him. I'm fighting off G's is what you're doing that as well and trying to get my bearings. And you guys are OODA looping. It's the truth is, as you said, the fighting scenes and who these guys are, whether it's fiction in Top Gun or fact as I'm talking to you right now. I mean, you're talking about top warriors.
It's, you know, obviously, you know, you're trying to find them while they're out there dogfighting, and I've got a little bit more training and experience than you, so that's totally natural. But it's an honor. It's an amazing job, and we love it. But it is hard, so to speak. But it's worth taking the time and learning to do it well, because it is the funnest job in the world.
And it is real that you have all these call signs. You're Thumper, Joker. I don't know who else went up with us that day. I can't remember the other call signs, but you want to go ahead and tell everybody how you got the name Thumper?
I do not.
Just like in the movie, you earn those call signs through a myriad and variety of ways.
The standard answer is I will be happy to tell you about it at a bar or over a beer, but that's the only way we usually divulge our call signs.
And that's
how you found out mine, because we went to the bar afterwards.
Which leads me to my second and final truth. You know, you see those scenes where Goose and Maverick in the first one are all these guys are having beers at the bar and it's camaraderie. It's not that we were at together, you and I, at a massively packed bar, but there is a bar right there at the base, right off the runway. So we got done, we went to the bar, and it was similar to that movie. I mean, we told stories, we laughed, we joked, and want to share with the audience. I don't know if this is Air Force wide. I don't know if it's fighter pilot wide. And we all had various drinks, but there's one drink we had to have.
Yep. Jeremiah Weed. And you had some for sure.
Drank out of a casing, right? A bullet casing.
20 millimeter.
And why is that? Why is Jeremiah Weed the drink for fighter pilots?
There's a bunch of different legends as far as where that hole came from. I believe kind of the prevalent one was a guy had ejected at Nellis and he walked to a random bar in the middle of nowhere, kind of like Tom Cruise did in this one. And this was the only alcohol they had. So that's that became his drink of choice. And that became the Air Force drink of choice. And there's several other close iterations of that. But that's just kind of when you join the community, you're just kind of told like, hey, this is what we do. And you take the shots as either like as a punishment or in remembrance or but it just kind of symbolizes all that we hold near and dear towards each other. And, you know, that's the movie does do a good job of portraying that, the camaraderie. And there's no closer group of, and this is not just limited to fighter pilots, but any other branch of the service. Like when you know, a sports team, like they're close together, you know, they're going to win a championship, but they have nothing on a group of warriors, men and women who are going to fight in true battle together, whether that's in an airplane or in a tank on the ground or whatever vessel they're using.
All right. Well, once a Mad Mallard, now a ninja, as I understand, as you move from the F-16 to the F-35. Look, I appreciate you doing this with me today. I know, you know, speaking in public wasn't your favorite thing to sign up to do. No, but I'm glad you did. And I appreciate our friendship. I appreciate what you did for me that day. And I'm really happy that my Dallas Mavericks embarrassed your Phoenix Suns.
Hey, Luca was the man. He took it home to us. So,
all right, Thumper, thank you so much.
Thanks, Will. We'll see you soon.
There you go. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I hope you enjoyed Top Gun Maverick. If you enjoyed this episode of the Will Kane Podcast, go give it, please, 5 stars at Apple or Spotify, or leave a comment on YouTube. As always, I'll see you again next time.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.